This is Tax Chats. Hello, I'm Scott Dyring.
And I am Jeff Hoops.
And we're here to chat
about taxes.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Tax Chats. I'm Scott Dyring, professor of accounting at Duke University, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and colleague and curator of the Tax Museum at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Jeff Hoops. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
What day is it today, Jeff?
Monday. It's Monday, the finest of all the first days or second days or third days of the week, depending on when you start your week.
And this is an extra special Monday because...
It is the answer you want from me that I don't like to give because I hate when people ask me questions that they think they know the answer and they also know the answer and I just have to comply with their little game, but I'll comply. April 15th. It's April 15th, Scott.
It is April 15th. It is tax day, a very special day over in the Tax Museum. Do people get free admission on tax day?
So we had an advisory council a few whiles ago and we hired a consultancy to calculate the revenue maximizing admission price. Of course, we're all about profits here in the Tax Museum. It turns out the revenue maximizing price is zero.
Okay.
And so...
So maybe that's why when I tried to call you earlier, there were people in the Tax Museum with you there.
There were people over here in my office, yep.
So, and by the way, Jeff was on Planet Money a couple days ago, and if you want to listen to Jeff on Planet Money, you can look up that episode. But... It was revealed that the Tax Museum and Jeff's office are co-located.
They are co-located, yep. It's a big revelation.
Jeff is broadcasting once again from the Tax Museum, which is co-located with his office.
Yes.
At the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Correct.
All right. So,
So Scott, a question for you.
Yeah.
It's tax day. Yeah. What have you yet to do? Why did you tell me literally as we were starting, it said, we got to hurry. I still got to.
I'm still working on my taxes. And sadly, when I logged into TurboTax a few minutes ago, it came up with the little circle and it said, we estimate based on your previous filings that it's going to take you 1 hour and 56 minutes to file your taxes.
And you got until midnight tonight, I think, until midnight. Right?
So
is it, do you know if it's midnight Eastern time or does it midnight wherever you are?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to. I also need to run down to the post office and mail a certain tax form, which I shall not discuss here publicly. But
mailing. There's a whole Simpsons episode about getting
there is. And
beginning of a Simpsons episode about getting to the mailbox in time to mail your taxes.
Yeah, so we'll see if I can make it to the, but it is interesting. I have been delaying the filing of my tax return because I hate doing it so much. And you might say, it's not that complicated. You're a professor at Duke. Just take your little form that Duke gives you and type it into TurboTax and you're good to go. But it turns out that my wife's family has an LLC, limited liability company, which means we get a K-1 from that LLC. And that complicates things a little bit. And then I have a blackberry farm, as you know, and that complicates things.
You always keep on switching between ranch and farm.
Well, today it's a farm. Sometimes it's a ranch. And that complicates things a little bit because I got Schedule F for my blackberries. And then I also have a little rental property. So that complicates things a little bit too. And so I have been procrastinating. And here I am.
Yes, you are. So this reminds me, I was talking to a reporter last week. Are you ready for this?
I can't wait.
And they asked me a question. I'm going to ask you the same exact question.
Okay.
And it's very related to what you were just talking to. They asked me, this is a fact checker person.
Okay.
And they said,
Is this the fact checker from NPR?
It's a fact checker.
Okay. And were they fact checking about your office to see if it's actually the Tax Museum?
They fact check everything.
Everything. Okay.
Everything gets fact checked.
Okay.
And fact checker calls, and one question they ask is, how long is the tax code? How many pages are in the tax code? What would you say to that?
I don't know the number, but I know it's probably in the thousands. And
is it closer to 10,000 or 70,000?
My guess is 10,000, closer to 10,000.
10,000. Why do you think 10,000?
A 70,000 page book would be really, 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 really big. I think what there is 10,000 pages of code and then another 60,000 pages of treasury regulations or something like that.
Yeah. So that I think is a lot. One big piece, this is a question that like has got a lot of airtime for whatever reason, I'm not sure why, is the separation between the tax code and the treasury regulations and other just like stuff.
Yeah.
Because I agree, a 70,000 page book would be very, very large.
Yeah. So how many pages does it have?
So that is a good question. It's quite hard these days, actually, to, well, not quite hard. Most people don't have physical copies of the tax code. So I do have many physical copies of the tax
code. Because like you're in the tax museum.
Because I'm in the tax museum. We got all sorts of them. Would you like me to fetch a physical copy of the tax museum?
I think that would be very fun.
You give me some fetching music and I'll get one.
So you go fetch it. I'll describe what Jeff's doing. Jeff has taken off his earphones. He's spun around in his spinny chair that's in his office. He had to leave his spinny chair. He's now walking. He's left the screen. So he had to go pretty far in the tax museum. He has gathered up one book, two, three books in his hands. They're quite thick paperback books. He's now sitting back down, but he has yet to put his headphones on, so he can't hear me. Okay, you're back.
Okay, I have 11 copies of the Internal Revenue Code. I just counted. In the physical copy, physical version of the tax museum, the digital version of the tax museum, the digital archives, we actually have probably 30 years worth of of tax codes.
So when you grab those three books, are those three different versions or is that 1 year?
So I have 1 year. So this is an interesting, like recently in the last decade or so, they've been printing it, or at least RAA has, in one single book. And they use much thinner paper.
One book.
So I got the two book version. This is what I used when I was in a Master of Accounting program. It's volume one and volume two from CCH. And they're both pretty fat, both pretty heavy. And watch, they're probably not going to have page numbers. Oh no, they got page numbers.
What year was that?
This is 2007.
2007.
Yeah, July 2007. So one of them has like 2,047 pages.
Okay.
And the other has.
I'm going to guess it's about the same. So you're going to be about 4,000 pages.
This one has 5,000. I don't understand the pages.
No, it just kept going.
Oh, just kept it going. Yeah, I got
so about, it's about 5, a total of 5,000 pages.
5,507 pages.
5,507. Okay.
And so two books.
I was right.
And two books. Okay.
Okay.
And so then the winter 2011 RAI, or sorry, this is Thomson Reuters, however you say that, RIA version is, are you ready for this? 4,000, just over 4,000.
And that's printed on like a slightly different size of page and so
it's,
forth.
It's text is way smaller.
Yeah.
Text is way smaller and the paper is way thinner.
Yeah. Okay.
In one single book. Okay. So inches wise, it might be 2 inches thinner.
Yeah.
Okay. So then here's another fact.
Okay.
Is that our amazing Congress gives us now, you can go to uscode.house.gov and download the entire revenue code in a PDF.
Wow.
And the PDF today, the most recent one they have on there, 7,058 pages.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. So now
I was right. That. Closer to 10,000.
You're always right, Scott.
Of course.
So why?
Could you please tell that to my wife?
I'm sure she thinks you're all right. Oh, actually, I learned something when I was doing this search for this reporter. So I've always known that the U.S. Internal Revenue Code is Title 26 of the U.S. Code. The U.S. Code is just like all our laws, and we got a lot of different laws, and the Internal Revenue Code is just one of them, Title 26. What I didn't realize is all the titles are in alphabetical order.
Oh.
And so Title 25 is?
I don't know.
Indians.
Really?
And Title 27 Native Americans. Is? As in Native Americans, I assume. I didn't look at it. It's literally just called Indians.
Okay.
And then Title 27 is intoxicating liquors.
So, really?
Right in between Indians and intoxicating liquors is the Internal Revenue Code, currently at 7,000 video pages. So why do you think the reporter asked me, here's what we're going to talk about for reals today, now that we've had this very long introduction. Why do you think the reporter asked me, like, does anybody care? It's not like she's planning her bedtime reading and needing to know how many pages to allocate per day or something. Like, why do we care how many pages in the Internal Revenue Code?
Well, I mean, I think the simplest answer would be we care because if it's super long, it's probably a big pain in the neck, as was the phrase used in the original Superman movie. Do you remember that? The guys from outer space come that are wearing black and they're blowing in the streets. And she goes, "You're a pain in the neck." Well, I think the Dax goat is a pain in the neck if it's too long. Long equals pain in the neck.
I was talking to a colleague about this, and I want to challenge your assertion. What if the tax code, let's say there's 300 million taxpayers in the United States. What if it was 300 million pages long, and every page said, Scott D. Dyring, tax liability, 2023, X dollars.
Yeah.
And that's what it said.
That would be fine. So in other words, that would not be complicated because everybody would have an individualized tax amount. But so that's fine. What you're coming up with is an unrealistic reason for why my page count proxy for complexity might not hold. But in fact, your assumption is wrong. There's not an individualized section for
okay,
each of
the, so what if the tax code instead could list out hypothetically every single type of transaction you could ever have and told you how much tax to pay on it? It's just like a list.
Yeah, that would be amazing. And we would get right back into some of the same issues that we've had before, which is if you want to tax it, you have to define it. So we would have to be able to define all those things. And if we could, that would be amazing, but we can't. So that's
but again, that would be very long and very uncomplicated. Yeah, all I'd have to look up is the tax code on being a 40-year-old accounting professor in North Carolina with five children and whatever.
Yep. I would agree with you there, but that's not the way it works. And I guess it depends a little bit on what you mean by complicated. I mean, complicated could, the very definition of complicated might be something like a special tax for every single circumstance.
But that's quite simple if you know the circumstance you're in. You just go to the lookup table, you write down, you like find the amount of tax. So it's not.
Yeah, it depends on what you mean by complicated or complex.
Yeah. So to me, when we talk about tax complexity, it's often in discussions around like investment or other types of behavior where the complexity of the tax code is like a burden. It makes it harder to comply. It makes it more costly to comply. It makes it less likely that I'll respond to incentives that are embedded in the tax code because I don't understand those incentives. And tax complexity is seen as this negative thing. Whereas you just said, if it was some people say the longer it is, the more complex it is, but the longer it is, maybe it's like spelling things out more clearly and precisely.
I think that I can see how you might envision that, but I doubt that ever happens in reality.
Okay. Next question. And we're going to talk about a lot of issues associated with the length of the tax code.
Well, hang on. I'm going to back up just a little bit. I want to talk more about this. Okay. So Jeff and I, for those of you who don't know, are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And one of the tenets of our faith is that people should pay 10% of their income as a tithe. And it is basically defined as 10% of your interest or increase, I think it says. 10% of your increase annually. That's it. Is that simple or complex? It's like a one-sentence definition.
Yeah. It's a very good question. I mean, according to our definition of how many pages are in the tithe code, there's a sentence. Less than a sentence. It'd be
very,
sentence.
Very simple.
Yeah, I think it mostly starts to get complex because you start thinking about, I mean, it gets complex for me because I think about the tax code and try to overlay the two and think about interactions with the two, as in like, there's so many places where we find it hard to define income and income types and income flows, et cetera. And we think about those things because of taxes. And then suddenly I start thinking, oh, what about tithing?
Yeah.
Most people, I don't think, have those problems because they don't think that hard about it.
True. Well,
and that I think is a good example. I mean, it's kind of like with GAAP and IFRS. I always say IFRS is like more principles based, and so it's not as, I guess, I don't know if anybody says it's more complex, but more principles based. But just because it's more principles based doesn't mean you don't have to make a specific decision about a specific thing, and it's might be actually useful to have specific guidance about exactly what to do.
So I don't know if you know this. There's a paper. It published in the journal Economic Inquiry in the year 2007 by Dahl and Ransom, and they surveyed members of our church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they asked them whether or not they thought things were tithable as a way to figure out whether or not people perceive things to be income. Have you seen this study?
Yes, I have.
I find it quite interesting. It's sort of like this, like if Jeff's grandma gives Jeff $100, is it income? Yeah, but what if Jeff's grandma gives him a couch worth $1,000? Nah, probably not. And people have these very interesting definitions of income in their brains, but you can't do that if you're the IRS. You have to actually define what is income, and then that creates a long tax code. And I don't know if that simplifies or makes it more complex, but it definitely makes it longer.
So why do you think the tax code, let's assume it is complex.
We don't have to assume. TurboTax told me it's complex. It's going to take me over 2 hours to file my taxes today.
TurboTax is trying to convince you that you needed their services. They would never just say, oh, this is actually really easy. You probably don't need to pay us your $100. Just go download a PDF and write it out by a pen and pencil.
That is possibly true.
Yeah. So let's assume it's complex, though. Why is it complex?
Well, I think, okay, here's my basic fundamental belief on that is it is complex because, I don't know, I don't think there's any one reason. I'll give you several reasons. Okay, I don't know if these are the reasons you have in mind or not, but here's some reasons. One reason is we have to define things in order to tax them, and defining them causes one to have to write down a lot of things. So that makes it long and it makes it a little bit complicated. Thing number two is
we were at a conference on Friday. We learned, I could not find them, but somebody alleged there was 100 pages of Treasury regulations defining when a project start date.
Yes,
is
exactly
as far as energy incentives under the Internal Revenue and under the Inflation Reduction Act. So all these things depends on like when you start the thing. So when is a project start date?
Well, here's another example. I was filling out Schedule F for the Blackberry Ranch. I'm going to call it a ranch this time. Which has a barn, and the question is, can you deduct a barn, or is it a...
Your pole barn or your tobacco barn?
Yeah, pole barn. And it turns out that's kind of a complicated question, and you have to define it. Is it used to house certain types of machinery used only for the production of your crops, or is it used for other things, and... when was it placed in service, and on and on and on and on. And then if you meet all the criteria, then you can take, for example, Section 179 accelerated depreciation. But you would think it would be simple, but it actually is not simple. So that's just another example.
So definitions.
So definitions is one thing. Okay, here's a second.
And why do you need the different definitions?
You can't tax something unless you can define it.
Okay, we've said that a lot of times. That's Rita. Rita just gave us that
quote.
That's
right. She did, yes. Rita de la Feria.
But I think a lot of that has to do with having a narrow versus broad tax base. If you have a broad tax base, you don't need to define. If I just said every piece of cash you get, pay X percent on.
Yep.
The end. We'd have to define cash. We'd have to define get.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
Okay. That's it. And people would evade by doing other things. But the broader the tax base.
Yes.
The tax base, the fewer definitions. And so part of why
we have those definitions. That gets right to my second thing.
Okay, there we go. Okay. We've segued,
as they say. This is my second thing, which is the second thing is the tax code has multiple objectives. And those objectives might be to influence behavior or to raise revenue or to, you know, redistribute income or whatever it is. And when you tax something, you distort the action of the taxpayer in many cases. And so as a result, in order to either increase or decrease those distortions, you probably won't have a base as broad as what you are thinking of, because you want to do things that perhaps don't distort income or don't distort investment or don't distort whatever as much as otherwise would happen if you just taxed every piece of cash that one touches or something like that.
I mean, I think a lot of that particular thing you're talking about is the equity efficiency trade-off, where we could have a tax code that's super, super, super simple, like a head tax, right?
Yep.
Everybody pays $30,000 and that's it. That's real simple.
If you're alive, you pay. At all.
If you're alive, you pay. You got a head, you pay. The only way to get out of it is to cut off your head.
Yep.
that's real simple, but that's not very equitable. At least some people wouldn't call it very equitable. So you make the equity efficiency trade-off. That would be very efficient, not very equitable. You got equitable by having a progressive income tax rate. Now that you have income involved, you got to define income. And maybe we want different types of income to be subject to different taxes in different places under different circumstances. And now we're worried about like defining a pole barn on a blackberry ranch for Scott
Dyer. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. What other reasons you got?
Okay, so that those are two reasons I've given you. A third reason, I think, would be because we have a political system that involves lobbying. And politicians want to get elected and reelected, and they are sensitive to the wishes of those who have money to give them, to take them to lunch and to do other things. And that can also cause nuances in the tax code to provide benefits or costs to one industry or another, or one business or another, or whatever it might happen to be.
Is this necessarily different than your last point? So let's say we want to be more efficient. So we want to like hone the tax code. So it's so perfect. I think the lobbyists would just tell you, oh, all we're doing is just telling the politicians how to make it more efficient. And if that so happens that we need a whole section to depreciate race cars differently than all the other race car tracks, differently than all the other kind of tracks, that's good for the economy. It's more efficient. It's better.
I do not doubt at all that those are the words that escape the mouths of the lobbyists. But I do doubt very seriously whether or not that is actually what is happening.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's certainly extremes on both sides, but I think that is kind of the purpose of lobbyists, is to convey information, and that information certainly benefits the people that hired the lobbyists. Obviously, that's where they hired the lobbyists.
Well, lest I be misinterpreted here, I do not think that lobbying per se is a bad thing. I think there is a role for lobbying, but I do think it can be, like pretty much everything on the planet, used appropriately and probably abused as well.
Yeah. So I would agree, though, that the tax code gets more complicated because specific taxpayers have incentives to want specific treatments for specific things, which might necessarily not align with the good of society. And politicians oblige and give them what they want in the tax code. Okay. What else? Why else is the tax code complex?
Well, okay. So those would be my main reasons, I think, we talked about already. I don't know. What do you think? What have I left off the table?
Okay. I think the tax code is complex because, and again, some of these are all related to the things that I've been talking about, but that we have a tax code, people respond to that tax code. They have incentives to change their behavior to get out of taxes, either by real decisions or, reporting decisions or timing decisions. They change their behavior to get out of taxes, given the current tax code. And it's an iterative game. Congress will change the tax code to try to respond to that. For an example, I think we had in the 80s, there's just like in the 70s, I think, I'm not like some kind of tax historian, although I'm a curator of a tax museum, not a tax historian, but like we had all of these tax shelters in the 80s that revolved around passive losses. And so then we get like this whole set of passive loss rules. Remember when I used to teach that when I was at Ohio State University, it's like one of my least favorite things to teach. It's like so complex, so mind-numbingly complex, but it was all just in response to these tax shelters that produce these passive losses. So now we've got to create this new concept to make it difficult to produce losses, engaging in activities in which you're not actively involved.
Yeah, one of my favorite cat and mouse stories in the tax code is related to what we sometimes call inversions or expatriation, where a U.S. company would decide that it was sick of being an American company, and so it wanted to be like a Bermuda company or something. And so they would kind of flip themselves. They would form a subsidiary in Bermuda, and then the subsidiary would buy the parent, and now the subsidiary was becomes the parent, and it's not a U.S. corporation anymore. And the government didn't like that very much for a variety of reasons, including the possibility that it might lose revenue, although I don't think the government lost too much revenue for that, to these inversions. But also the optics were bad and so forth.
Just felt bad. Made you feel sick in your heart.
Makes you feel terrible that the American companies don't want to be American anymore.
It's Benedict Arnold corporations. That's fleeing right. To exactly. Bermuda, just like Benedict Arnold
himself.
Some
of the greatest traitors of all time. They want to be Bermuda corporations and not American corporations.
Yeah.
Shame on them. And there's a whole interesting legislative history of, well, the firms were doing this little trick, and so then that gets shut down, and then they start a new little trick, and then that gets shut down, and a new little trick, and eventually it finally was shut down when the incentives were changed, because now the U.S. rate is sort of roughly comparable to foreign rates, and there's not as big of an incentive, and I don't think companies want to do it. But it's a very interesting cat and mouse game, and the tax code certainly got longer because of that.
Yeah, every time you say shut down,
that's more that pages.
We get that's more pages. That's yeah. more that's more sections or
exactly.
whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I got another reason.
All right.
It's kind of the same as this another reason you already said, but you have to have like a little caveat. The tax code is complicated because life is complicated. Okay.
Okay.
But the caveat,
I agree,
and kind of the what you have to say about that is that we also have to make the policy decision to have the tax code reflect life.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean, that's true.
It's if you want to, again, simplest tax ever, head tax.
Yep.
But that doesn't reflect the fact that different people might have different capacities to pay tax. And, you know, some people think equity would demand higher income people pay more in tax, all this kind of stuff. So,
well, and also just our economy is so diverse. There's just so many ways to, you know, make money, lose money, buy property, sell property. Like you could do it in like a thousand different ways.
But again, it's a policy decision to make. It's a policy decision we already talked about to go with efficiency or go with equity over efficiency or efficiency over equity to make that trade off in one particular way for a given situation that makes the tax code mirror the complexity of the real world.
Okay. So now I have a question for you. You seem really bothered by the fact that, I don't know if you're bothered, but you're interested in, I think would be the right way. It's fascinating to you that the tax code is complex. Now you're fascinated by a lot of things, but, as is evidenced by the museum behind you.
Pretty much fascinated by everything.
Okay. So just fascinated by a lot of things, but very fascinated by the complexity of the tax code. But like, who cares?
Who cares?
Yeah. What's the big deal?
So why, what's the consequence? So
I mean, TurboTax is clearly happy that it's complicated, but like,
yeah.
You know,
so, but every dollar that makes TurboTax happy is a dollar less that Scott's going to have at the end of the day when he ends up filing his taxes and he pays TurboTax. So, I mean, the most obvious and simple answer is there's just a tax compliance burden that we face, both in terms of paying tax preparers, paying tax preparation software companies. It just makes the administrative burden of the tax code larger to have to employ professionals to help us comply with it. But second, beyond that, it's just the more complicated the tax code, to the extent that our real world decisions are influenced by the tax code, it just imposes this cost on all real world decisions. If I'm going to build a factory and I don't know exactly what the after-tax cash flows of it because I don't know exactly how it's going to be depreciated, that increases my hurdle rate for building the factory. Like it'll make me harder to know how much factory to build, so to speak, if I don't understand exactly what implications are because the tax code is complicated. Likewise, a third thing, well, I guess this is the same as the second thing, but we have incentives in the tax code. We want certain behavior to happen. And that behavior is going to happen less frequently. The tax code is being less efficacious in incentivizing that behavior to the extent that it's hard to know whether that behavior qualifies for the tax code. And so for the R&D tax credit is an example. We think that that research and development creates some kind of like social good. It creates this positive externality. And so we want to stimulate more R&D than private parties would do so on their own. So we have the R&D tax credit. The more complicated is the R&D tax credit, the less certain I'll be that I'll actually get it. And so I sit there and do the calculation for how much credit I'm going to get for every unit of R&D. In expectation, I'll get fewer credits the more less certain I am about getting it, therefore it'll stimulate less R&D.
Yeah.
So it'll be less effective.
Yep.
The more complicated is the tax code.
Okay. So I had an interesting experience about that related to this topic when I took a little sabbatical to Oxford University in 2017. And I was there in the fall of 2017, right before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed. And there were lots of stories in the news about things that were being discussed and so forth. And one day I was invited to some kind of meeting and they were sitting around the table were probably 8 or 10 like CFOs and tax directors of companies. And then there were a couple of policy people. And then there was like me and Mike Devereaux, who's a very influential tax scholar at Oxford. And I just sat there and listened. And what was interesting to me was the topic of discussion was about whether or not the rate would go high or go low in the US and how that would affect these British businesses. And what they all were saying is, we don't care if it's high or low. We just want to know what it's going to be and for how long it's going to be that thing, because what they wanted was certainty so they could plan, so that they could make better investment decisions going forward.
Yeah. And I think that's a whole separate thing than we've been talking about right now. So there's tax complexity, which is how to interpret the current tax code, how to map pre-tax income into after-tax income given the current tax code. Tax uncertainty is, to me, at least, I would define it, what you're talking about is Congress can always change that. Like on a whim, they'll change that.
I think there's two things, actually. So what I talked about is exactly what you're saying. Like the future could change. And there's also tax uncertainty, which is some things that Congress has enacted, two very reasonable people who are not trying to cheat could completely miss or completely disagree on the interpretation. And it's not clear what the outcome will be. And that uncertainty is also
And bad. Even better, two people who are trying to cheat can really disagree.
And of course, there are some people, I don't know if you remember. So Doug Shackelford, who was a tax professor at UNC and eventually the dean of Keenan Flagler, is now retired. But Jeff and I both know him. He used to always tell us when he would teach seminars that the tax return for many businesses, they consider that their first offer in a negotiation with the IRS. So that's one way to think about it.
Yeah. Okay. So the tax code's probably complicated. Actually, I want to do one last thing.
Okay.
I want to make the case that the tax code isn't that complicated.
I think I know where you're going with this, but make your case.
Okay. For most people, I think it's actually most. Like 50% of people.
Probably more than 50% is my guess.
They basically have income from their job. They might have two jobs. They might like have a side gig. They might have a bank account that earned $30 in interest. That's going to produce two W-2s, one 1099, or two and two 1099s.
Two 1099-INT.
Yeah, an INT and either a MISC or a NEC, depending upon the exact thing that they're doing for their side gig.
And the fact that we just said those numbers scared people, but it's not hard. You just get a form in the mail.
Yeah. So that's kind of the point. They're going to get four pieces of paper in the mail and they type all the boxes. There's going to be a box 1A W-2. They're going to type 1A on the W-2 in TurboTax and press enter. And once they've kind of copied over the 30 boxes from those four pieces of paper, and they can count how many children they have and know whether they're married or not, they're done.
You know what's interesting, though? I mean, even that very thing gets more complicated because I believe that whether or not a child qualifies you for different things, like a deduction versus a credit versus whatever.
You have to know now their age.
Yeah, and they're defined in like four different ways.
And where they live. Yeah, so this goes back to...
So now all of a sudden it's complicated again.
But
for most people, it's actually not that complicated.
Yeah, most people it's not that complicated. Yep. But I think it is interesting, though. I think that because for some people it's super complicated, we talk about it as it's super complicated. And so everybody's assumed it's very complicated. For a lot of people just with very ordinary income and ordinary circumstances, not that complicated. A, B, I think it is the case that we certainly think about, Scott and I are going to think about it differently than most people, because most people are simply less adept at thinking about forms and numbers and things like that, right? I would hope at least that accounting professors are more adept at thinking about those kinds of things. And so the average person just might not be as numerate as one might hope.
Yeah, I agree.
And it gets complicated and overwhelming.
Speaking of taxes,
you got to finish your return.
Well, and my brother-in-law, who is a CPA and is the accountant for the Flat Creek Inn, which is the family motel. I texted him before we got on the call, and now my phone is blowing up because I said I received one K-1, which was for a partnership, but I think there should be more. And he's like, yeah, I sent three more. Why don't you have them? I can send them again today. and I don't have them. So
feels like you're extending.
I may be extending. We're going to find out.
Well,
good luck. I better get to it because I'm running quickly out of daylight. I think that's it for this lovely tax chat on tax day, April 15th, 2024. Thank you for listening. We'll chat with you next time if I'm not in jail for tax fraud. Goodbye.
Bye.